What is the best thing in the world you could have? And all of the kids who are in here could now all say Jesus. And that's accurate, but if we could think just a little bit more precisely about it. What is the best thing in the world you can have? According to Jesus, a man can gain the whole world without profit to his soul if he forfeits his soul in the process. That makes it sound to me as if the best thing you can have in the world, at least in that discussion, the best thing you can have in the world is your soul. But that's not really enough or specific enough, is it? That the best thing in the world you can have is your soul. And for that matter, what does it even mean to lose or forfeit one's soul or to have one's soul? The best thing in the world we can have, we can get, we can gain, the best thing we can gain is our soul. And I think we have our soul. We are most alive when we are in fellowship with our glad and gracious God. I think that's what it means to be alive, is to be in fellowship with God. That's what it means to have one's soul, is to be alive to God, to be relating to our glad and gracious God. What is better than being with Him, knowing and seeing Him, thanking and praising Him, seeking and depending on Him, lingering in His presence, and of course that's more in terms of our consciousness. We are, in one sense, always in His presence, but there is a way where we can be thinking about that more specifically. And when we're considering His attributes, His person, His works, when we are praising Him, rejoicing, singing, worshiping Him in that, and even then expressing our need for Him, our prayers of supplication that we would continue to depend on Him going forward. To have one soul is to be alive to God, and living in fellowship with God is the best thing. But we get consumed with so many other things than that. We get consumed trying to have or gain our souls amidst many distractions, and in particular, many distractions from fellowship with God, even in places devoted to worship. That's the thrust of the concern in the passage we're going to consider this morning. That it is easy to be distracted from fellowship with God, even in places devoted, places set apart for sake of fellowship with God. Men tend to complicate or misdirect and miss the point, and a man can lose his soul in the temple of God just as he can lose his soul in the world. And we tend to only be concerned about men seeking after things and losing their soul in the world, when in fact it's just as possible in the temple of God, at least for what we'll see Jesus talking about to the Jews in John chapter 2, it is just as possible to lose one's soul and to miss fellowship with God in a place devoted to worship. God has given men instructions on how to have fellowship with Him. He gave it to His people in the Old Testament. He's repeated and clarified instructions for fellowship with Him in the New Testament. Even more than that, God became flesh so that men's souls could be saved, so that they could become alive to God and have fellowship with Him. But oftentimes men mess it up, and we find Jesus confronting a group who had lost fellowship with God as their goal. That was not their aim. That was not their goal, even at the focal point of God's presence among His people Israel. Last week in John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, we saw Jesus' first miracle. He turned water into wine at a wedding in Cana in order to facilitate their party. And one of the cases that I made is that in facilitating their party, He was also facilitating their fellowship with each other. In today's passage, John chapter 2, verses 12 through 22, we'll see Jesus' first confrontation, where he clears the temple in Jerusalem in order to facilitate their worship and their fellowship with God. His first miracle facilitated fellowship. His first confrontation was about fellowship. One, fellowship with each other. This miracle enabled that. Now the cleansing of the temple, the clearing of the temple, the confrontation of their disbelief was in order to enable or facilitate their fellowship and their worship of God. John moves us from Cana to Jerusalem through Capernaum in verse 12. You can look at that after this. He, that's Jesus, went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. Jesus ends up making Capernaum his home base for ministry. We keep seeing Capernaum. Jesus keeps going back to Capernaum throughout the story of his life. Born in Bethlehem, sojourned in Egypt, spent a lot of time growing up in Nazareth, but his home base for ministry was Capernaum. Here's where we see him go there for the first time, along with his mother and his brothers and his disciples. His brothers are likely half-brothers. Some commentators see brothers as a more broad term that might even include his cousins. I don't think there's any reason to draw in his extended family. Jesus had half-brothers, younger siblings, who had Joseph and Mary as mother and father. So Jesus had half-brothers. His disciples at this point, as far as we know, are five in number. Five followers who went with him to the wedding. They go with him to Capernaum, and we find out that they also go with him to Jerusalem here momentarily. Now this transition in verse 12 does help us track Jesus' movements, but even more, it helps us and it argues that Jesus cleared the temple twice. Because the next event, starting in verse 13, takes place at the temple in Jerusalem during Passover. And all four Gospels include a situation where Jesus was at the temple in Jerusalem at a Passover. All four Gospels include an event like that. Matthew chapter 21, Mark chapter 11, and Luke chapter 19. But all three of Matthew, Mark, and Luke relate a temple clearing at the end of Jesus' ministry, at the beginning of his first, or at the beginning of the last week of his life before the crucifixion. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke all talk about a temple clearing, but they talk about it at the end of 3 years. And none of the synoptic gospels include a temple clearing at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. So the first three gospels include one clearing of the temple at the end. In John's gospel, he likewise includes, this is the passage, Jesus at the temple in Jerusalem during the Passover, clearing the temple. But this seems to be at the beginning of his ministry, and John doesn't mention one at the end. So none of the gospels mentions two. And the first three seem to mention it at the end of his life, at the end of his ministry. John mentions it here at the beginning. So was John the apostle writing John's gospel, was he rearranging the chronology in order to make a point? It's tough to make that case based on verse 12. It's tough to make that case based on the reading. He seems to be providing not each and every individual detail along Jesus' movements, but there's enough here. There's enough details that aren't found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke include details that aren't found here to make the simple and, I think, obvious answer that there were two temple clearings. And on one hand, you may think that just sounds like running commentary, but the significance of observing that is Jesus makes quite a splash onto the public scene. His first miracle was relatively private. It was at a wedding in a small town, and not even everybody at the wedding knew about it. Now he goes to the capital city of the nation during their most important festival, where people from all over the nation were visiting, to the place of worship that God had identified, and he clears the temple. That's done at the beginning of his ministry as well as at the end. So he makes quite a splash, quite an impression. For being relatively unknown up to this point, it would be hard for him to be unknown after this point. So the two temple clearings is significant. He got the attention of the religious establishment right away and confronts their soul problems. That is S-O-U-L. He confronts their soul problems right from the start. By doing so, he demonstrates not only that he is the Lord of worship, but that he is the object of worship. He does not only rule the temple of God, he himself is the temple of God. And the Jews never encountered a point that they couldn't miss. And they certainly miss this point big time. So, two paragraphs we're going to consider, verses 13 to 17, and then verses 18 through 22. Verses 13 through 17, Jesus clears God's temple for sake of fellowship. He clears or cleanses the temple for sake of fellowship. He had just solved a wedding problem. Now he solves or confronts a worship problem and clears it out. Clears out the distractions. Verse 13 shows us the scene. John mentions multiple Jewish festivals throughout his account, throughout the rest of the gospel, and this is the first one. Verse 13, the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Passover is one of those really tricky words to figure out what it was talking about. Passover was a festival that commemorated, that celebrated when the angel or the death angel passed over. Passover. When the death angel passed over all the houses of the believing Israelites who had slaughtered the lamb and wiped blood on their doorposts. They were instructed to do that. If they did not do that, and none of the Egyptians did that, then the death angel did not pass over, but rather went in and killed the firstborn. And that slaughter was the final straw, so to speak, that broke Pharaoh's will, as well as the rest of the Egyptians, to kick the Jews out of the country. The final plague, the final demonstration of God's power, the killing of all the firstborn. But the Jews' firstborn were not killed if the angel passed over their house. According to Deuteronomy chapter 16, the Passover was to be celebrated. It was to be a time of worship every year. And all of the men of Israel, 12 and older, were to, if able, if capable, they were instructed to go to Jerusalem to the temple. It was, I've mentioned or likened some of the annual celebrations where the men were required to go to Jerusalem. There were three of them every year. That would be a lot of shepherds' conferences or, you know, pastor, minister, man, promise keeper type of promise keepers when there, you know, was a reason for it kind of thing. I'm not trying to throw promise keepers under the bus a whole lot, just the idea in our heads that men were supposed to go to the temple, to Jerusalem. That's what we find Jesus doing. That's why he goes to Jerusalem. That's the scene. The problem comes in verse 14. Things were not as they were supposed to be. In the temple, verse 14, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there. There's two Greek words translated both with the English word temple in this passage. This is the Greek word heron, translated temple. It refers probably to the temple complex. We use the word campus today. And the temple complex or the temple campus had lots of different areas, many different parts to it. The more specific or temple proper is identified by the Greek word naos. So this is Heron, then there's naos. This is the temple complex he's talking about, more than the Holy of Holies, that more specific temple area inside. And probably this area is the outer part, the court of the Gentiles. This is where Jesus sees the problems, because the Gentiles were only allowed in this furthest out part. they were prohibited from going very far in at all. I mean, there were multiple levels to pass through to get into the centermost area, to the core. But this was the only place for non-Israeli God-fearers to pray and fellowship at the temple, and now it was filled with other stuff. The court of the Gentiles was still considered part of the larger temple area, and it was identified to be a place where those God-fearing Gentiles could come and worship, where they could come and not be distracted in their fellowship with God. Instead, we see oxen and sheep and pigeons. And the reason for all these animals were for sake of sacrificing, since many Jews, they were required to travel to Jerusalem for this festival, for Passover. Those who had long distances to journey over, it wouldn't have been convenient for them to bring their animals to sacrifice, so this was a service for them. Dare we even say it was a ministry? Some group of temple people were in their staff meeting on Monday morning talking about how they could serve all of the people and minister to them by providing animals for sacrifice for all of these travelers during this particular feast. It made sense as a service for these incoming pilgrims. The money changers likewise provided a helpful service because the law required a temple tax for every male 20 and up. So every male 12 and up was to go to the feast. Every male 20 and up had to pay this particular tax, and they had to pay it in a particular kind of coinage. So if you lived in a region where that wasn't the coin that you would use for your business, for your commerce, then they would come and they would exchange their money and get the right type of coin for the tax. These tables, these money-changing tables, were only set up during this time. So what was the problem? If they needed animals for sacrificing, and if they had to pay the temple tax in a particular kind of coinage, what was the problem? And I think, unlike what seems to be Jesus' emphasis the second time, the second cleansing, I think this time he is confronting their location. He's confronting their presence in the temple, in the court of the Gentiles. The problem isn't overcharging. It is their existence in the temple. It's possible, and we probably could go ahead and even say likely. It's likely that even at this point there was overcharging. There was fleecing due to greed. Buying things in the airport is always more expensive because you have a captive group of buyers. Well, these people wouldn't have had other resources, so this is the place where you would come to get your sacrifice or exchange your money. So no doubt there could have been some problems due to greed, but the bigger problem is that they were distracted from the temple's purpose, which was fellowship with God. There may have been a helpful place for those services, but it was not to be the temple. They could have done their vending on the other side of the road, but they didn't. That's the problem. So verses 15 and 16 give us the clearing. Jesus takes severe action, making a whip of cords. Were you reading the King James? The NASB? Did it say a scourge? Yeah. What does the King James have? Scourge. He made a whip. A scourge. Scourge sounds even like it hurts just saying it. But a whip would hurt as well. He made a whip of cords and drove them all out of the temple. By the way, who does that mean the whip was hitting? He made a whip of cords. He drove them. Who's the them? The sellers. He drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. do not make my father's house a house of trade. Wouldn't this have been the time, this is low-hanging fruit, but wouldn't this have been the time for Jesus to engage them in a conversation? Have some dialogue. Sit down. Talk it out. You know, there is totally a place and time, certain situations where you should sit down, have a conversation, and talk it out. But not every situation requires that. It certainly didn't require it at this point. He whips them out and clears the distractions. And it must have been at least a fairly chaotic scene. Oxen are large. And presumably there were more than one oxen. I mean, there was more than one ox. There were oxen. Sheep, however many sheep there were, those animals and those who were selling them, driving them out, must have been some scene, and yet not so much of a scene to get Jesus arrested for disturbing the peace or whatever the charge might have been. So he gets them out quick enough. There's not as much of a riot that would put him in jail at this point. But the tables full of coins make a lot of noise when overturned. He speaks, he addresses those with the pigeons, because more than likely the pigeons were in cages. So he spoke to those in charge of the pigeons to pick up the cages and get them out. But then at the end of verse 16, his rebuke confirms, I think, that his concern here was about the distractions. In the Synoptic Gospels and their description of a temple cleansing, specifically, you hear Jesus talking about turning his father's house into a den of thieves or a den of robbers, which seems to me that has more the emphasis of the fleecing and the overcharging of the people. But here he specifically says, don't make my father's house a house of trade. That's the ESV. NAS and King James have the, don't make it a house of merchandise. NIV says, don't make it into a market or a marketplace. In other words, there's a place for business, and it's not here. Here is for something else. This is a place for fellowship with God. It is interesting that no one stops him, because they outnumbered him, even if there were just two of them. He is one. They certainly outnumbered him. We assume in human terms, at least, they could have overpowered him. Maybe it's just that they were startled. They were in shock at how quickly everything happened. But no matter what, the event demonstrated Jesus' authority. It demonstrates his authority over his father's house. He represented his father, and the temple was, in fact, his father's house. The disciples then make a connection in verse 17. The scene, the problem, the clearing, and now the connection in verse 17, because his disciples apparently saw the whole thing take place. His disciples remember that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Some question exactly when his disciples did this remembering. I think that they made the connection immediately. Look down at verse 22. It says that the disciples remembered something else. You know, at the end of that paragraph, they remembered another thing, but it specifies the time of that remembering as after he rose from the dead. Here it seems like they do the remembering. They make this connection right on the scene. And so in verse 17, they remembered Psalm 69:9. If you've got a study Bible or even a Bible with cross references, undoubtedly it tells you in the margin somewhere, this is the verse they were thinking about. This is what they remembered, where David wrote, "Zeal for your house will consume me." And David wrote that in its original context as he was being persecuted because of his desire for God, his want of fellowship with God at the temple. David had a zeal. He had a passion for sake of his soul to worship God, to be in God's glad presence at the temple, and he wrote that zeal would consume him. And when we use that word, when we even say zeal consume someone. We largely have in our minds that what it means zeal will consume someone is that zeal fills them up. They are totally characterized by zeal. That's not what David meant, and that's not what Jesus' disciples think about Jesus. David meant in Psalm 69 that zeal for his father's house could kill him. He was under attack, he was under persecution, and zeal, passion for fellowshipping with his God at the temple, was not appreciated by his persecutors, so much so that he feared they perhaps would persecute him to the point of destroying him, consuming him, killing him. Again, when David said, "Zeal for your house has consumed me," he's thinking perhaps of the ultimate consequence, the destruction, not being full of zeal, but being destroyed by others because he was zealous. And that's exactly the concern that the disciples have watching Jesus. "Jesus, you keep acting like this, you are going to get yourself killed. You act like this, you are going to be consumed. You are going to be destroyed by these people. They're not going to appreciate it." That's the idea of consumed. Even in the title of the message, consumed as God's temple, if the emphasis or the meaning here was just to be full of, well, then to be full of as God's temple doesn't make sense. But to be destroyed as God's temple, consumed as God's temple, that's the danger. So Jesus clears God's temple for sake of fellowship. They just missed the point. They were prohibiting the God-fearing Gentiles from a place where they could come and worship God. The second paragraph, verses 18 through 22, not only does Jesus clear God's temple, but Jesus explains that he is God's temple for sake of fellowship. Jesus is God's temple for sake of fellowship. Though no one stopped him from clearing the temple, Jesus does get questions about his authority to do so. And whereas he has been unknown except to a smaller group up to this point, now he becomes known as he confronts their disbelief. So verse 18, we see the interrogation. John doesn't tell us which Jews came and confronted him, but more than likely it was some of the religious leaders, maybe even some of the Sanhedrin, those who had responsibility to oversee the temple activities. It's not the ones who were doing the buying, and it's not even the ones who were doing the selling. It was the ones who allowed the commerce, the ones who organized it, the ones who took the fee for the business people to have their own table to sell the stuff. So the Jews said to him, verse 18, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" Now, if they'd have been keeping score at home, or if they'd have been paying attention, the clearing of the temple itself, isn't that a sign? Doesn't that make kind of a large point as it is to come in and make a whip and drive everybody out? If they'd have been paying attention, they would have seen that as a sign. Maybe not a miraculous sign, but still a sign. And yet they demand a sign for him to say he had the right to do the sign he already did. He already showed them something, and now they're saying, "Show us something else to prove it was okay for you to have done the thing you already did." And that's not just because they wanted to believe. That's part of the reason I'm emphasizing it, is because they're asking for something to make their unbelief of the first thing reasonable. To make it sound reasonable that they didn't believe the first demonstration, so demonstrate for us something else. It's because they don't believe and they're looking for an excuse for their unbelief. They were more concerned about whether or not Jesus had the right to do what he did than if Jesus was right. And I want to get all conversationally and step out from behind the pulpit and say, man, we are guilty of that. As a principle, to wonder whether someone is right to ask us particular questions or to make particular observations, we are way more concerned about whether they have the right to do it, not if they are right. And man, we've got our defensive techniques up at that point. Rebellion, especially religious rebellion, always takes the high road. It loves precedent and protocol, authoritative titles and words and pedigrees, finding someone lower on whom to roll the blame. They ask why Jesus did what he did because they didn't like what he did. They're looking for him to prove, maybe they can get him to not be able to fulfill this part so that they don't have to deal with what he actually did. He did what they should have done or what they should have never allowed in the first place. Those who are questioning him about whether he had the right to do it were questioning because they were wrong, not because Jesus wasn't right. They demonstrate that they were satisfied with something other than fellowship with God. I say that because had they really desired fellowship with God, they would have loved Jesus. If they would have been seeking after fellowship with God, they would have been seeking after Jesus, who was God. Instead, they wanted their rebellion, but to make it look like their rebellion was righteous. Like they were protecting the righteousness of the temple, because how dare we let this unknown guy come in and just stir things up? That was the interrogation. Verse 19 is Jesus' response. He answers with sort of a riddle. It's not a riddle like we would have or would fill up our riddle books, but it's sort of like a riddle. Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." I'm calling it a riddle. Some commentators use some other types of words to describe what this is. But a riddle is where you use words that people know in a way that kind of confuses them. In a way that hides the point rather than make it obvious. And so Jesus uses words they know and explains his authority in a way they couldn't possibly understand. And really he's offering to do another sign, sort of. They say, show us a sign. He says, okay, destroy this temple. There's something that they have to do first. Destroy this temple. And the first level of meaning that temple refers to is the stones that made the walls of the temple. So tear down these stones. Tear down this structure of fellowship, this house of God. Tear it down. And obviously that's what the Jews who were questioning him thought he was talking about. And yet in verse 21, we see a second level of meaning that in Jesus' mind, there was another level because he was not only talking about the temple of stones, he was talking about the temple of his body. He doesn't make it clear now what he's talking about. The Jews did not get it. And for that matter, his own disciples didn't get it. We'll see in verse 22, they didn't get it until after he rose from the dead. That means, for then, if this temple cleansing took place at the beginning of his 3-year ministry, that they heard him say this and had no idea what he was talking about for 3 or so years. And Jesus wasn't panicked to make sure that they got it all right at one time, right at the beginning. So why would he answer like this? Because he knew that those who were questioning him didn't believe, they didn't want to believe, they wanted their control. And they expressed their disbelief in verse 20. They expressed their incredulity. Incredulity is just an intense word to describe an unwillingness to believe. Verse 20, the Jews then said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? Most of the temple was completed at this point, though most historians say that the entire complex wasn't fully complete until AD 63, which then gave them a whole 7 years to enjoy it before the Roman Empire destroyed it. That's sadly ironic. Herod the Great began rebuilding the temple in 20 or 19 BC. So it had been being built for a long time by now. 46 years, they say, and they couldn't believe that Jesus could raise it in 3 days. And you know what? I bet they wouldn't even believe if Jesus created the universe in 6 days. I bet they wouldn't believe that either. In fact, I bet they couldn't believe that Jesus would be killed and rise from the dead. I bet they'd not think that was possible either. In fact, I bet they wouldn't even believe that they would in fact destroy the temple he was talking about. They did do it. They just didn't do it as they understood it. They destroyed the temple that Jesus was talking about. So thankfully for us, the gospel writer John provides some clarification in verse 21. John knew now when he was writing what he didn't know then. Because remember, we think, since he never mentions himself, but that John, the writer of the gospel, was one of those original disciples, one of those first five. So John would have been there watching this and hearing this. John admits he didn't know what Jesus was talking about, but thankfully he clues us in a little bit earlier. Verse 21, Jesus was speaking about the temple of his body. The Jews may not have torn down the temple, but they had already destroyed it in one way by making it a place for something other than fellowship with God. And not only that, they would destroy Jesus, the house of God, God's temple in the flesh. Jesus was the fulfillment of the temple, and I'm not going to go into that in great detail, because John the writer doesn't go into that here in great detail. But the temple was the place where men came to meet with God in his special designated presence. And now they don't meet with him at a particular place, but in a particular person. And that is, as an aside, really exciting. Because we're not close to Jerusalem. God's presence resided in a building previously and now in a body, and Jesus was consumed. He was, in fact, destroyed. He said, destroy this temple, consume this temple. And why was he consumed? He was consumed because of his zeal for God. He was consumed so that we could have fellowship with God. He was consumed as God's temple. And again, John, the writer, gives us clarification and then tells us in verse 22 that they did remember it eventually. The remembrance. As I said, Jesus' own disciples didn't understand what Jesus said at this point. So John writes, when therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. That, by the way, is a pretty significant foreshadowing of what's to come. Because up to this point, we didn't know. If you had just been handed the Gospel of John, you knew nothing about the Bible, you knew nothing about the Gospel, and someone handed you the Gospel of John as a booklet, and you read that, the tendency for us who have read it a bunch of times is to skip over it. But if you're reading this for the first time, when therefore he was raised from the dead. Wait, what? That means to be raised from the dead, he's going to have to be dead. So this is a significant foreshadowing of what is to come. Foreshadows the death of Jesus and his rising from the dead. And the resurrection vindicated Jesus' words and Scripture. So they believed Scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. They believed and followed initially. They believed more last week we saw when Jesus turned the water into wine. They'll keep believing more as they see Jesus doing particular signs throughout the gospel. And then they believed more and more when he rose from the dead. And all these things are written so that we might believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and that by believing we may have life in his name. And this still is for us. It may not be a miraculous sign at this point, but when he confronts those who had distracted people from worship and fellowship of God, and even says, I am now going to be the way to fellowship with God, when he dies and rises again from the grave so that we can have life, that is the best thing in the world. And that best thing is only possible now in Jesus. Worship is about fellowship with God. The special presence of his fellowship is no longer bound by one location, but it is still exclusive. That it is still bound by one person. There is fellowship with the glad and gracious God. There is life for your soul, for our souls. There is the best thing for us, no other way than through Jesus. He is God's temple, and he was consumed, destroyed on our behalf. Our sin keeps us from God, and he was killed so that we might have life, so let's not clutter that up and busy ourselves with all of the other things that distract us from Jesus. Jesus gives us lots of responsibilities. Jesus gives us assignments to go and do a lot of things, but those things can never replace him. The animals and the money changers were not necessarily a problem. There was a place for them, but it was not where the fellowship with God was supposed to take place. And there are lots of other good things for us today, but not if they replace Jesus, not if they replace our fellowship with God in him. And just as there used to be only one place to go for God's presence, so now there is only one way to get to God, and that is Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through him. Do you believe in Jesus? Or have Christians done such a miserable job of making Christianity full of so much other stuff that Jesus is missed? Christians, we need to confess as sin if we are distracting other people from Jesus. And if there's someone here who doesn't believe, Jesus is the best thing. He's the only way your soul can have life and you can have fellowship with the only glad and gracious God. Father, by your Spirit and by your word, on behalf of your Son, make him clear. Remove all of our distractions. Let us come to Jesus. Let us come to you through Jesus. Let us celebrate the life, the alivedness of our souls that we have in your Son. Draw men, women of all, every tribe, tongue, and nation to yourself through him, that he would be honored by the life that you are making in us and among us. Thank you for sending your Son. Thank you that because of zeal, he was consumed on our behalf. Thank you that he was raised from the dead so that we could have life in him. And we pray all this in his name. Amen.